You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
An exhibit called Infinity of Nations, Art and History in the Collections of the National Museum of the American Indian has just opened at the George Gustav High Center in the Customs House at Bowling Green. The show includes more than 700 objects from North, Central, and South America, and it's accompanied by a handsome catalog published by Harper. I'm very pleased to welcome its curator, Cecile R. Gantome, to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
The Customs House facility was opened 16 years ago, but isn't this the first major installation of the museum's collection?
This is the first time that a substantial cross-section of the museum's collection will be on display in New York City.
So are we going to be seeing things here that we've never seen before, at least not in this building?
You will be, yes.
What does the title Infinity of Nations refer to?
Well, the title of Infinity of Nations is taken from 17th and 18th century French colonial documents. The first use of the expression that we were able to find was in a 1626 French Jesuit report. But I learned of the expression from an Ojibwe historian who teaches at the University of Michigan, Michael Witkin, and he studies the relationships between the Anishinaabe or Ojibwe-speaking peoples and the French colonists in the Upper Great Lakes area. Michael was drawn to the expression because for him, it reflected France's inability to grasp Anishinaabe social and political organization, and therefore their frustration in being able to strengthen their imperial grip in the region. This understanding of the expression appealed to us. We also liked it because it conveyed the fact that the Americas were filled with a multitude of peoples, and it was not the pristine and uninhabited New World of European imagination. And then, of course, the word nations was very important to us because it reflected the fact that the European colonial powers did respect the sovereignty of native peoples. Now, this is a sovereignty that native peoples have had to fight to protect for the last 400 years, but it is a sovereignty that we respect at the outset of the exhibition.
And there are a wide variety of different aesthetic sensibilities here, but many of the works on the show have some practical purpose, clothing, baskets, pottery, tools. There are paintings and sculptures, but do these Native American cultures, and I'm talking about the full range from the tip of South America to the top of Alaska, do they distinguish between functional items and works of art?
Well, it was very interesting. In the New York Times review of the exhibit, there was a comment that the reviewer said that it was long drone in to him that Native peoples have no word for art in their languages. But he was saying, obviously, what here's on display shows that they had great aesthetic sensibilities. But I think he was actually missing a point, because when Native Americans used to make that statement, I think they were objecting to a certain class of objects going on display. I don't think they were ever denying the aesthetic dimensions of their work. What they were opposed to was the display of holy objects, objects imbued with power, and they were opposed to those objects being presented as art.
Well, we've had a similar kind of situation with African art, haven't we? Where even a comb can be a beautiful piece of art, but many people in Africa are upset that works that were intended to have special religious powers are on display in museums.
Yes, that is the objection of Native people across the world.
So is this something that curators have to deal with on a regular basis?
Oh, most definitely. In the past, museum curators did not respect the viability and the ongoing nature of Native cultures and traditional cultures, so it never occurred to them to work with Native people in the curation and displays of their exhibitions. Now this has all changed. In any museum that has Native objects in their collection, there is almost always collaboration and consultation with Native peoples.
And having some of the objects that were owned by the Smithsonian and by the museum that used to be uptown here in New York sent back to Native peoples?
Yes, there have. The enabling legislation for the National Museum of the American Indian, which was known as the National Museum of the American Indian Act of 1989. It did call for the repatriation of certain classes of objects, burial remains, associated burial remains, sacred objects, and objects of cultural patrimony.
This really began with the museum that used to be uptown on Broadway and 155th Street.
Correct.
And then that building was closed, and there was a big debate at the time as to what to do with the collection.
Well, the
send it to Washington, keep it here in New York.
The High Foundation's endowment was dwindling for several decades, and it got to the point where the Museum of the American Indian High Foundation had to find a new home, new institutional support. And it ended up that it was absorbed by the National Museum of the American Indian Act. I mean, the act of that enabled the creation of the museum called for the transfer of the collection of the High Foundation to the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian.
Originally, there was talk about sending it to Washington, but we wound up with this beautiful facility down in Bowling Green.
Yes.
Used to be the Customs House.
The U.S. Customs House. Well, the two New York senators at the time, Senator D'Amato and Senator Moynihan, insisted that the museum maintain a presence in New York City because the original charter of the High Foundation said that the museum was for the people of New York.
Who was George Gustav High?
Well,
and did he put together most of this collection?
Yes. George Gustav High essentially amassed the collection single-handedly over a period of 60 years. George High's story has to begin with his father, Carl Friedrich Gustav High, a German immigrant who owned an oil refinery in Pennsylvania and who in 1876, when High is 2 years old, sells it to Rockefeller when Rockefeller is buying up small independent refineries. The elder High rose through the ranks of Standard Oil, eventually taking charge of the Foreign Shipping Department. He passed away in 1899. When his wife, George's mother, passed away, George inherited $10 million. And, of course, it's his inherited wealth that allowed him to collect on the incredible scale that he did.
800,000 pieces, I've heard.
Yes.
Wow. My guest is the curator of a new show at the National Museum of American Indian, the one in downtown New York on Bowling Green. The show is called Infinity of Nations, Art and History of the Collections of the National Museum of the American Indians. I'm talking with the curator, Cecile R. Gantaume, G-A-N-T-E-A-U-M-E. So we had this incredible 800,000-piece collection. We have 700 pieces on display. Are the other things not worthy of our attention?
Oh, not at all. A lot of pieces are on display in Washington. We have a very extensive loan program, so pieces go out to loans to tribal museums as well as other museums. And then we have the collection available for researchers, including Native people in Washington.
The exhibit is organized geographically into 10 regions from Tierra del Fuego up to the Canadian Arctic. Is this a departure for the museum?
It is a departure for the museum to organize exhibitions geographically. But as we explained to the visitor right from the start of the show, that these geographic sections should never be understood as having been bounded or static, but that long-distance trade, ritual exchange, intellectual exchange, military conflict, political expansionism, diasporas, they all created a high degree of interchange throughout Native America.
I remember going to the ruin of a pueblo in, I think it was New Mexico, and there were macaw feathers and there were abalone shells, obviously neither of them indigenous to the area. So even in the American Southwest, there was that kind of trade.
Throughout the Americas, it's evident from the earliest history that Native peoples were having reasons to and finding ways to bridge vast distances. For example, we have banner stones that are used to for their balances for atlatl weights to make spears grow further. They date to about 6,000 BC, and these banner stones are found at distances that are from very great distances from where the stones were quarried.
Now, one of the things that all of these cultures seem to have in common is headdresses The exhibit opens up with headdresses representing that full move from the southern tip of the Americas to the northern tip.
Yes, the headdresses represent the 10 geographic sections into which the exhibit is organized. They also represent the sovereignty or right to self-determination of Native peoples. As we tell the visitor, the right to don the headdresses within a society depended first on one's ability to use their acquisition of cultural knowledge, and second on their ability to use that knowledge for the benefit of their peoples.
There are certain things that seem to be in common in all these cultures. They all carve, or pretty much every culture has carving. We have carved gourds from Peru, carved stone released from Central America, carved ivory from Alaska, and some art forms seem to be found throughout the Americas, like basketry, beadwork, pottery. Was that just simply because these things wind up becoming part of the development of a unique civilization, or do you think that was also because of exchanges of ideas?
Well, it could very easily have been exchange of ideas, but also certain areas and certain people specialize. So the Northwest Coast are known for their carving. They're not known for their pottery. They didn't make pottery. The Plains Indians didn't make pottery. California Indians are very well known for their basketry. They didn't do carving to any great extent.
Was this also because of what was available?
Yes, exactly.
But there is one big difference between what happened with Asia and Europe, where there was a lot of exchange, and the Americas. We had that little place where North and South America meet, and it was hard to get across, wasn't it? Didn't that slow things down, the exchange of ideas? Like, for example, the Incas never had written language, even though written language was common in Mesoamerica.
Well, the Inca had a vast empire. Their empire stretched from Chile all the way up to Colombia. And so they, for example, we have a quipu on display. A quipu is a knotted string device. It's a horizontal string from which hang a number of vertical strings, twined in different technologies, in different colors, and knotted in different ways. And this quipu somehow encoded quantitative information that allowed the quipu, that allowed the Inca to administer their vast empire.
Are there any items in the collection that you're especially proud of and fond of? Things that are rare or unique?
Well, there are many. One of the objects I like, just because it would strike the visitor as being incongruous, they wouldn't understand what it's doing in the show. It is a European-style wedding dress, and it belonged to Suzette La Flesche, who is the first nationally known Native activist. She was Omaha and was born on an Omaha reservation. She descended from Omaha tribal leaders on both sides of her family. Her father thought it was important that she attend a missionary school, which she did. Then she went east to school. She returned home to Nebraska just in time to see the Ponca peoples being forcibly removed from their homelands. She then witnessed the Ponca chief and several other Ponca men who attempted to return to Nebraska be arrested. These events launched her on a career of activism, and she argued against the forced removal of Native peoples and for Indian citizenship rights.
It and some other items that are among the treasures in this show, a carved gourd, a Mayan bas-relief depicting a ball player, an ancestral Pueblo stone jar, a basket, a headdress, and that wedding dress are all part of a slideshow that we have put on our website, on our show page at WNYC.org, so our listeners can get a sense of the kinds of treasures you have in this exhibit. There's also this marvelous catalog that you have all in full color that is almost as good as going to the show. Not quite, because you do want to see these things in three dimensions. But it is an extraordinary show called Infinity of Nations, Art and History of the Collections of the National Museum of the American Indian. It is published by Harper and Smithsonian.
Yes.
And my great thanks to the curator of the show, Cecile R. Gantome, for being our guest today.
It's been my pleasure.